This is Morning Edition from NPR News. Good morning, I'm David Greene.
And I'm Renee Montaigne. In Your Health Today, the connection between depression and dementia.
But first, freshmen are heading to college this fall, and about now they might be getting their roommate assignments. Some colleges allow students to pick their roommates. Others assign roommates to students. And there's some new information about the effects that college roommates might have on each other. NPR social science correspondent Shankar Vedantam regularly comes in to discuss research he finds, and he's in the studio with me. Hey, Shankar.
Hi, David.
So I'm thinking about my college roommates and the influences they might have had on me. I mean, am I going to like what you're about to tell us?
So it turns out that your college roommates actually have a pretty big effect on your mental health. And to understand what that effect is, what you need to know is that researchers have found that the risk of depression is connected to something called your cognitive style.
Cognitive style. And is that just sort of the way we think about things?
Exactly. So bad things happen to all of us, but we don't all think about those bad things in exactly the same way. I spoke with psychologist Jerry Hafel. He's at the University of Notre Dame, and he gave me an example. Here he is.
Two people both lose their jobs. The question is, why is it that one person becomes depressed and another one doesn't? Some people are going to think that losing their job means that they're a failure, and they're going to brood about their negative mood, and that person's at risk for depression.
Okay, so we have two people who might be responding to the same problem. I'm guessing that the person who kind of just brushes it aside might be less likely to get depressed. The person who kind of broods about it is more likely to get depressed.
Yeah, exactly. So if you're a student, you don't think that failing one exam is the same thing as being a failure. You know, you distract yourself, you go out and you tell yourself, I'm going to bounce back.
I'll get over it.
Yeah, exactly. So Hafel asks, what happens if you suddenly start spending time with somebody who has a very different cognitive style than you? Now, when students show up at Notre Dame, they are assigned roommates. Students don't get to pick who their roommates are. It's fairly random, right? So regularly, people who have a positive attitude are going to get paired up with someone who has a negative attitude. And what Hafel found is that in just 3 months, roommates started to infect one another with their cognitive style. Here he is again.
What we found is that these thinking styles were contagious. If you came to college and you had a roommate who had a very negative thinking style, your own thinking style became more negative.
Okay, I don't want to oversimplify, but I mean, are we saying that if we come to college in a good mood and we end up kind of feeling depressed a few months later, it's all our roommate's fault?
Well, see, on average, that is sort of what Hafel is saying, that having a negative person around you a lot of the time has an effect on you. But it's also important to remember, David, that this actually works both ways. So it's true that the brooders made the cheerful kids more, you know, broody, but it's also true that the cheerful kids made the brooders more cheerful. So now instead of blaming themselves when something went wrong, the brooders started saying, well, you know, it's just the circumstances and I'll bounce back. I'll start doing better. So it's almost as if the thinking styles of the two roommates were converging, right? Hafel is a depression researcher, and what he finds is that 6 months after you start spending lots of time with somebody with a more negative attitude, your risk for depression significantly rises.
Let's broaden this out, if we can, and get some perspective. I mean, if we take this beyond college, how important is it that we find people who are upbeat, you know, to spend time with, to make sure that we don't get depressed?
This is why I like spending time around you, David, because you're always
nice
cheerful.
You.
But, you know, the truth is, in life, we can't always surround ourselves with cheerful people, right? People are going to come in all shapes and sizes. The big takeaway for me from Hafel's study is that these cognitive styles are actually quite malleable. It used to be that we thought that these styles were fairly fixed. You know, once you're a brooder, you're always going to be a brooder. Or once you're a cheerful person, you'll always stay a cheerful person. What this experiment is showing us is that our peers and networks have a really powerful effect in shaping us. When we start spending time with somebody who is a very different temperament, it's the psychological equivalent of essentially landing in a new country. And so our natural cognitive style, this mental language that we've always spoken, doesn't work anymore in this new country, and you have to start learning this new language. And so the takeaway for me is, with effort and time, we can all change our cognitive styles.
It's an upbeat ending to this chat.
I think so.
It's been great sharing a room with you. You've been a wonderful influence, Shankar. Thanks a lot.
Thanks, David.
It's NPR's Shankar Vedantam, and you can follow him on Twitter at Hidden Brain.
Depression can also have physical consequences. Research now suggests that people who get depressed in middle age and later are more likely to develop dementia in old age. NPR's Patty Naiman reports that researchers are trying to understand why that occurs and what can be done about it.
The link between depression and dementia is really something of a mystery. Merrill Butters is a brain researcher whose work is focused on answering this question.
What is it about a mood disorder that is relatively treatable, that people recover from, what is it about a mood disorder in the brain that may increase one's risk for dementia many years later?
Dementia can be caused by either the plaques and tangles that clog up the brain in Alzheimer's disease, or by a series of mini strokes that impair the brain in vascular dementia. In a recent study at the University of Pittsburgh School of Medicine, Butters found the risk for both types of dementia nearly doubled among people who had suffered depression after the age of 50. She says there are some clues about why that may be. For one, the mechanism that causes arteries to harden elsewhere in the body also plays a role in the brain.
So depression's associated with inflammation in the body, which can thicken blood vessels, making it difficult for blood to get through and nourish the brain and give the brain all the oxygen that it needs.
And a less nourished brain may mean greater vulnerability to dementia. Even if this theory doesn't hold up, Butters says there's no harm in doing for your brain what you do for your heart. Maintain a normal weight, eat a healthy diet, and exercise regularly. Another clue, she says, that may link depression to dementia involves the stress hormone cortisol. Butters says when people get depressed, they produce excess amounts of cortisol. That could be problematic for a part of the brain called the hippocampus.
And it just so happens that the hippocampus has a lot of cortisol receptors. So it may be that if you have high levels of cortisol circulating for long periods of time, you can sort of burn out these receptors and they die, and then the hippocampus shrinks.
While the hippocampus shrinks with normal aging, Butters points to a study that found it was even smaller in middle-aged women who had a history of depression compared to those who didn't. And as it turns out, it's one of the first regions of the brain to show symptoms of dementia. It's responsible for short-term memory, and people often forget things that just happened, like what they ate for breakfast or what they just said to someone. Dr. Charles Reynolds is a geriatric psychiatrist at the University of Pittsburgh Medical Center. He says preventing depression could be an important defense against dementia.
I think the good news is we can help older people and their family caregivers take steps to protect themselves from becoming clinically depressed.
Reynolds recently looked at ways to help older adults prevent depression. In his study, counselors visited people in their homes looking for problems that could lead to depression. Things like difficulty sleeping, lack of exercise, poor nutrition, feeling alone. Counselors helped the older individuals tackle these problems themselves. And in the end, the grim predictions that one in four older adults would suffer major depression just didn't pan out for this group.
Over a period of 2 years, the incidence was reduced to about 8 or 9%.
That's down by two-thirds. So now the next step is for researchers to determine whether lowering rates of depression among middle-aged and older individuals can also protect them against dementia. Patty Namond, NPR News.
You know that song, "A Twinkling Star Might Be a Child's Delight," but it's an astronomer's nightmare. You see, stars don't twinkle. They only appear to twinkle because the Earth's atmosphere distorts and blurs their light. One way to beat the twinkle is to put your telescope in space. NASA plans to launch the James Webb Space Telescope in 2018 to replace the aging Hubble telescope that's in orbit right now. But the James Webb telescope costs nearly $9 billion. A technology called adaptive optics is actually a much cheaper option. It lets telescopes on the ground see almost as well as those in space. NPR's Joe Palca has been doing a series of stories about inventors and their inventions, a series that we call Joe's Big Idea. And today Joe looks at the remarkable things that you can do with adaptive optics.
Have you ever looked down a long straight road on a hot day, and off in the distance the road appears to be shimmering? Just about any hot surface will cause the same kind of blurring. The shimmering occurs because hot air just above the road bends light a little bit differently than cooler air higher up. Well, that's what twinkling is all about. Tiny fluctuations in the temperature of the air between you and the star you're looking at. Adaptive optics compensates for those fluctuations, so an astronomer like Andrea Ghez of UCLA no longer has to ask of stars, "How I wonder what you are."
It's just like the curtain opening, and you can see things that you could never see before.
Seeing things clearly is essential for progress in science. It's true for biologists looking inside cells. It's true for astronomers looking at stars and planets.
Adaptive optics has really revolutionized so many fields in astronomy. One of the most exciting recent ones is the study of planets outside our own solar system. Just 15 years ago, we didn't know about any other planets around stars outside our sun. And yet now, not only do we know about them, but we actually can take a picture of them with this technology.
Gez doesn't study planets. She studies the giant black holes that exist in the center of galaxies. Adaptive optics has transformed her research, too.
You can actually see the stars that reside right around the black hole, and we can see matter falling onto the black hole thanks to this technology.
And it's not just scientists who want to see things clearly.
The Russians chalk up another victory in the space race as they put...
At the start of the Cold War, the Pentagon decided to gamble on the then unproven technology of adaptive optics so it could see what the communists might be threatening us with from space. Robert Fugate is a scientist at the Air Force Research Laboratory at Kirtland Air Force Base in New Mexico. Back in the late 1980s, he designed one of the first really successful adaptive optic systems. I asked him if he remembered the day he first knew the system worked.
Like it was yesterday.
Oh, wow. Tell me about it.
Well, it was, you know, like 1 o'clock in the morning. We were at the 1.5-meter telescope, and we were looking at a star. You know, a big blobby mass. So I said, well, you know, everything looks okay to me. I think we should try it. So we hit the return key on the computer, so to speak, and wow, you know, we had this huge blob on the screen that went to a point. And holy cow.
Of course, the military is interested in looking at things besides stars, but once you have a way to compensate for atmospheric blurring, you can look at anything you want. There's a modern version of the system Fugate built installed on the Keck telescope on the top of the Mauna Kea volcano in Hawaii.
Okay.
Peter Wisinowicz has driven to the top of Mauna Kea to show me what these adaptive optic systems are really like. Wisinowicz has been involved with the Keck system from the start.
So if you go to your right...
He takes me up in an elevator to a platform surrounding the telescope, and we go into a small structure attached to the telescope frame.
So this is the adaptive optics enclosure. And what you're hearing is we turned on a HEPA filter when we came in.
Wisinowicz takes the panel off a large box. Inside are all kinds of mirrors. This is the guts of the adaptive optics system.
Light from the telescope comes in that far end there.
Wisinowicz says the atmosphere is doing two things to the light as it comes down from the stars. One, it's making the light move around or jiggle.
And it's also smearing it.
Adding to the blur.
And what adaptive optics is trying to do is taking out that image motion.
So it uses one mirror to do that. And then, after a computer calculates how the light is being smeared, an adjustable mirror unsmears it. Wisinowicz points out the small round mirror that does the unsmearing. It has 349 adjustable elements that move up to 1,000 times per second to restore the starlight to the single point it really is.
That's amazing. It looks like a bathroom mirror.
Well, except its coating's on the front surface,
And
I hope it's a lot better quality than your bathroom mirror. Otherwise, we'll buy from the same vendor because this was expensive.
Now, there's one problem with adaptive optics. You need to have a bright enough star to make the corrections on. It used to be if you wanted to look at a patch of sky with no bright star, you were out of luck. But Andrea Gez says scientists have figured out a way around that problem. They create artificial stars using a laser.
So we shine a laser up into the atmosphere, and there's conveniently a very thin layer of sodium atoms up at 90 kilometers, and this laser can stimulate those atoms to shine like a star. And then we can look at that star, that artificial star, and make the corrections.
That's how Bob Fugate's system worked. That's how the Keck system works. Although the Keck adaptive optics system has been incredibly successful, Wisinowicz says Keck is planning upgrades. Now that astronomers have a taste of what's possible, they want even better adaptive optics systems to see even finer details. So do eye doctors. Yes, I said eye doctors. Not to see stars, but to see the fine structures at the back of the eye. Austin Rorda is at the optometry school at the University of California, Berkeley. He says just like the atmosphere, the cornea, lens, and fluid inside the eye also distort light, so engineers have developed an adaptive optic system for the eyeball.
What it actually represents is really a paradigm shift
in how one would use ophthalmoscopy to study the eye.
Ooh, wait a minute. Say that word again. Ophthalmoscopy?
Ophthalmoscopy.
Ophthalmoscopy is the act of taking pictures of the back of the eye. Rorda thinks adaptive optics could have an important role in diagnosing and treating eye diseases like macular degeneration and retinitis pigmentosa, because adaptive optics gives you a way to see individual cells at the back of the eye, cells that are damaged by diseases.
We may have a tool that will allow us to measure the efficacy of a treatment that may slow the degeneration of those cells or even restore those cells' function.
Now, Rorda is looking at the outside of individual cells. He says the next frontier is looking into the cells themselves, a sort of adaptive optics for microscopes. Anytime there are new technologies for seeing the world more clearly, scientists make important discoveries. Remember Galileo and his telescope? He advanced scientific knowledge quite a bit with his new technology. Who knows what Andrea Ghez and other modern scientists will do with theirs. Joe Palca, NPR News.
Supporters of gun control have suffered some political defeats in Washington, but Senate Majority Leader Harry Reid insists new gun control legislation might still be in sight. He is working with Vice President Joe Biden on a plan to bring the issue back to the Senate floor. Now, even if it does return, one proposal that's unlikely to survive is an assault weapons ban. Military-style assault rifles now form a nearly $1 billion industry in the United States, supported by gun owners who are willing to spend thousands of dollars collecting these specialized weapons. NPR's Elsa Chang wanted to learn more about the appeal.
There's a lot of name-calling in the gun control debate. Gun control advocates are the elitist urban liberals who want to take everyone's guns away. Gun rights people are the paranoid rednecks who think the government's out to get them. And then there are the special labels reserved for people who love their assault rifles.
You know, they picture you as some kind of militant freak, and that's not me.
Mike Collins says he and his wife own more than a dozen military-style rifles. But before anything else, he wants you to understand something. He is a rational, intelligent, regular guy.
You know, I've spent 27 years in the military. I defended this country all over the world. I've been in multiple combat tours. I'm not a nut. I'm not a crazy guy. I'm just a normal person who enjoys shooting.
And for Collins, target practicing with an AR-15 is a hobby. We're at the shooting range at Clark Brothers Gun Shop in Warrenton, Virginia. Next to him is Jason Glasscock, who brought me out here because he thinks if more Americans knew what it was like to shoot these weapons, they'd see these guns can actually be good, clean fun.
And then this trigger finger you want to have up, move your grip up a little bit. There you go. And then you go ahead and take a shooting position.
I'm holding an AR-15 for my first time. The fully automatic version of this gun, the M16, was introduced by the U.S. military during the Vietnam War. The AR-15 is semi-automatic, which means you need to squeeze the trigger for each bullet.
I'm getting the hang of this.
You got this. Look at you.
When Glasscock explains why he keeps collecting military-style guns, he doesn't bring up self-defense or hunting. His eyes light up when he talks about all the fun ways you can customize an AR-15. Flashlights, night vision, even an attachable beer bottle opener. You can get the gun in neon green or with zebra stripes if you wanted. The accessories can cost more than the weapon itself, which starts at about $800. Mike Collins agrees. When he modifies his AR-15, it's like a guy souping up his car.
This is the man's Barbie doll, you know, the Mr. Potato Head of firearms, because you can interchange so many different things to make it customized to you to be able to make it comfortable when you shoot.
But this Mr. Potato Head is deadly. The AR-15 was the gun used by Adam Lanza, who opened fire in Newtown, Connecticut last December. 26 people were killed, 20 of them first graders. Everyone was shot more than once, as many as 11 times. And that's what the military wanted out of this gun. The ability to kill, even without good aim. A weapon with high-capacity ammunition magazines that could spray bullets within close to medium range. Tom Diaz is a gun control advocate who's long followed the commercialization of military firearms.
Those design features in a civilian market have horrific consequences. So you can call it whatever you want, tactical rifle, black rifle, assault rifle, modern sporting rifle. It has the capability that the military wanted for warfare.
How did warfare enter the civilian market? AR-15 rifles were sold to the public as early as the 1960s, but Diaz says their popularity really took off in the 1980s, after Chinese manufacturers began exporting the AR's Russian counterpart, the AK-47, to the U.S. And then pop culture helped the market along. Television shows like Miami Vice made military-style firearms look sexy. Military-style rifles have now ballooned into a billion-dollar business. The main gun industry group, the National Shooting Sports Foundation, tells NPR these weapons represent about 20% of the entire industry's revenue. Imports and production of these weapons almost quadrupled in the last 10 years. When you watch advertisements for these guns, you'll notice a central message. Get in touch with your inner G.I. Joe. Take this commercial from Sig Sauer, which features soldiers in combat boots crouching next to military Humvees.
I need a firearm that's torture tested.
Engineered to the highest possible standard.
Fired thousands of rounds without fail.
Built in America.
AR-style modern sporting rifles are a major contributor to the success of the American firearms industry, no question.
That's Mike Bazinet of the National Shooting Sports Foundation. He says despite commercials like the one you just heard, the gun industry is not driving the market for military-style weapons. It's the consumers who want them. But gun control advocates aren't buying that. Diaz says the industry is filling a demand it was forced to create. National survey data show the percentage of American households that own guns is declining. He says kids these days would rather pick up a video game than a hunting rifle.
It's just a fact that hunting has been in serious decline. So those kinds of guns just don't sell as well. Well, you're in business, you got to sell something. These assault rifles, these military-style rifles, appeal to a broader range of people.
So, he says the industry pounced on these products to stay relevant. With fewer households to sell to, Diaz says gun makers have to keep coming up with newer, sleeker, more high-tech weapons for people who already own guns. Now, more than 30 gun companies make AR-15s. About 8.5 million assault rifles have been either manufactured in the U.S. or imported here since the 1990s. Gun dealers like Clark Brothers Gun Shop say someone comes in to buy one of these rifles almost every single day they're open.
If you want to put a light or a laser or a forward grip on there, you can change the stocks on them, triggers, you can add sights, whatever you want to do.
Okay. All right, I'll take it.
Okay.
How's that for a sale?
Mitch May has been the general manager at Clark Brothers since 1962.
Well, we've got guys that come in here on their 18th birthday and buy an AR-15, the first gun they ever bought, just because it's a gun that the military uses, and they want to have one just like it, but they don't want to join the Army to get it.
After the shootings in Newtown, Connecticut, May says he couldn't keep the AR-15 in stock. Between December and February, he estimates he probably could have sold 40 AR-15s every week. Even if most people think a federal assault weapons ban has slim hopes of passing anytime soon, the mere threat of a ban always brings in great business. Elsa Chang, NPR News.
This is Morning Edition from NPR News. I'm Renee Montaigne.
And I'm David Green. Good morning. We are looking this morning at a sensitive debate about organ donation. In Richmond, Virginia today, the nation's organ transplant network begins considering some new policies. They're focusing on how to allocate kidneys and other organs fairly and also how to increase organ donation overall. NPR's Rob Stein tells us more about one proposal that is sparking an unusually intense debate.
Since doctors started taking organs out of one person to transplant them into another, there's always been one big fear about organ donation. Stuart Youngner is a bioethicist at Case Western Reserve University.
You know, I'm very sick. They could save me, but they're not going to, so they can get my organs. I mean, in its rawest form, that's the fear.
So there's always been one clear rule. No one should even raise the possibility of a patient becoming an organ donor until either they're clearly dead or there's no hope and either the patient or their family has decided to discontinue care.
From the beginning, the organ transplantation establishment has recognized that you must keep them separate. You must keep the people who are taking care of and making decisions about the potential donor separate from those who are trying to get an organ to put it into the recipient.
But that might be about to change. The United Network for Organ Sharing, which runs the transplant system, is considering new guidelines. Guidelines that would say individual hospitals and their local organ banks can decide for themselves what to do. Christopher Hughes of the University of Pittsburgh is on the committee making the proposal.
The best way we felt to handle the very delicate decisions about approaching families was to have the hospital and the organ procurement organization work together to decide in individual circumstances how best to approach a family.
The guidelines deal with a specific type of organ donation that's becoming increasingly popular. It involves people who are not yet brain dead, but they can become organ donors after being taken off a ventilator to let them die. In that scenario, a lot of decisions have to be made very quickly.
The organs have a very short time period, measured in minutes, after the pronouncement of death for those organs to be removed to where they can still be transplanted.
But the proposal is setting off alarm bells. Some bioethicists and advocates for the disabled worry patients or their families may feel pressured to make decisions too quickly. Stephen Makochik works for the National Catholic Partnership on Disability.
Just think about coming into an ICU and seeing your child as a result of an automobile accident on life support. You're going to be extremely upset. And if a physician comes in and says, well, the prognosis doesn't seem very good, and then a procurement officer comes in and says, well, look, let's make something meaningful out of this, you might decide right then to agree to take the person off life support so some of the organs can be harvested. The problem is that it could well be that your child will, you know, regain some consciousness. There's just no way of telling at that point.
Bioethicist Stuart Youngner says the proposal marks the latest example of organ banks becoming increasingly aggressive.
In one of the hospitals that I'm affiliated with, they try to be introduced to families early, not as organ procurement organizations, but as end-of-life care specialists.
Another bioethicist, Boston University's Michael Groden, says such tactics could end up undermining the whole organ donation system.
Patients in general might develop a lack of trust in the system, and actually it may backfire and have people to be less likely to donate because of concern about people coming in and wanting their organs.
For his part, Hughes says the proposal includes lots of other changes aimed at protecting potential donors. Organ bank workers, for example, would be prohibited from getting directly involved in giving patients drugs to preserve their organs.
The idea of the potential for exploitation of a possible donor, we don't want that to even be a perception that that is the case.
The Organ Network's board of directors is meeting for 2 days beginning today to try to decide where to draw that fine line between honoring donors' wishes and saving lives and protecting seriously ill patients. Rob Stein, NPR News.
Time now for another Crime in the City, our investigation into crime novelists and the cities they write about. Today, Walter Mosley's Los Angeles. His series here follows Easy Rollins, an African-American Army vet turned private eye from just after World War II up to the 1960s. NPR's Karen Grigsby Bates visited the crime writer through a part of L.A. he says shaped him and Easy.
At the end of Walter Mosley's last Easy Rollins novel, Easy had driven off a California cliff. His violence-prone best friend, Raymond Alexander, Mosley fans know him as Mouse, brought Easy back alive in the latest book, Little Green. When Easy is partially recovered, Mouse asks him for a favor. He wants Easy to go find a kid named Evander Noon, nicknamed Little Green, who has disappeared after hanging out with some hippie kids. Here, Mosley reads a passage from the book describing Easy's meetup with Evander's worried mother, Timbal.
Her eyes were wide and her fists trembling. Timbal wore a shapeless purple dress that had probably been stitched in Mexico, smuggled into Southern California, and sold downtown, replete with fake tags.
Classic Mosley. With just a few words, we know Timbal has little money and even less time for fashion. She's wearing a badly constructed knockoff dress that's been made by one set of poor people across the border and sold to another set here.
Okay.
I've picked Mosley up at his Westwood Hotel near UCLA's campus, and we're traveling toward Easy's current neighborhood. In the car, Mosley tells me why the Rollins books are set in L.A.
Well, the great majority of black people came from Texas and Louisiana did come to Southern California around Los Angeles because the most work was here.
Like me, a lot of colored folk from Texas and Louisiana had moved out to California to get them good jobs in the shipyards and in the aircraft companies.
Hey, Willie!
That was Denzel Washington in the 1995 version of the first Easy Rollins book, Devil in a Blue Dress, a whodunit about murder and racial identity. Easy moved to Los Angeles. Walter Mosley did the opposite. He left the city of his birth decades ago for New York.
One of the reasons that I left Los Angeles is because I was oppressed by the feeling that how I lived, who I lived with, where, was going to define my entire life.
Like Easy, his creator wanted more freedom and more opportunity to live his life as he saw fit. Mosley and Easy see the city through the same lens. It's a place that's constantly filtering, separating the vast majority of the have-nots from the slim number of haves. LA's topography emphasizes that, Mosley says. Poor and working-class neighborhoods remain isolated from better-off sections of town. The boom years that put so many shiny high-rise offices and apartments on the city's west side did not touch the parts of town like South L.A. that he and Easy know best.
A lot of L.A. hasn't changed at all.
But that's outwardly. The small houses and businesses in South Central L.A. and in neighboring Watts look very much as they did when L.A.'s black community was thriving here when Easy first arrives in the 40s. What's changed, Mosley says, is who lives inside. And that racial and ethnic turnover is quintessentially Los Angeles.
My understanding of L.A. has always been like this. Even if you don't move out of your house, everybody around you will have moved within 3 years. And in essence, you have moved because you're not in the same neighborhood, because you're not around the same people.
Mosley doesn't have much regular use for a car in New York, but he remembers how good it felt to drive here. He wrote about it in Little Green.
LA at night back in the 60s was a wonderful place to drive. There were lots of people, but it wasn't overcrowded. The avenues and boulevards were wide and open to free-flowing traffic.
And he still knows the streets here well enough to act as my flesh-and-blood GPS.
Let's go to the middle of the 1300 block of Genesee, which is just about a half a block north of Pico.
Yep, I know where it is.
Genesee is a quiet street shaded by big trees. Mosley pushes back his straw fedora, spreads his arms wide, and breathes in the fragrance of freshly cut grass.
Such a nice day. My God. Ah.
We walk a few blocks down to Pico Boulevard. Here, it's noisy and painfully sunny, and the air is scented with exhaust from the buses that rumble past.
When I was a kid in the 60s up into the 70s, this was like the Pico was the dividing line. You know, mostly black people didn't live above it, and like a good percentage of black people lived below it.
And some of the landmarks here show up in his books, like a working oil well disguised behind the facade of a high-rise office building.
So this is it. This is that giant oil well that Easy's always talking about, which has been here since I was about 14.
This part of the city is crisscrossed with alleys, which gave Mosley the chance to use one as a location for a speakeasy.
So I put one of the illegal bars, Cox Bar, on one of the alleys.
There's a lot of this city in Mosley's latest book, from the street carnival that was Sunset Boulevard during the mid-60s to a forested lot in Compton. The forest hides the carefully hidden home of a root-working healer named Mama Jo, whose concoction gives Easy strength to find his man. As the series progresses, Easy moves several times, reflecting the actual migration patterns of post-war black Los Angeles. In Little Green, he's living on this mid-city block. He stays with a friend to recuperate from his accident, but
when he got out, he comes back home to this block, and a white guy has squatted in his house.
Easy, with some help from his volatile buddy Mouse, evicts the squatter.
And, you know, it was Mouse, so it wasn't a gentle dislodgement.
We've walked a couple of miles on a lot of the streets Mosley knew intimately as a teen. The route has included a couple of Easy's houses, the junior high Mosley attended, and the real sites on which several imaginary buildings appear in his books. We prepare to part ways, but before we do, a final surprise. Mosley stops in front of a pink fourplex with fancy diamond-paned windows.
So this is the house my parents owned, the front and the back. Yeah, we lived in the back. It's a great place. I love it.
And it's just around the corner from Easy's house. Once again, Easy Rollins and Walter Mosley intersect. If you ask Mosley how much of him is in Easy, he pauses before answering.
You know, not much, I don't think.
Okay, then, what do they have in common?
Other than Los Angeles, I don't really know.
I do. Walter Mosley and Easy Rollins share a passion for social justice and a plain-spoken eloquence that makes people pay close attention to what each man is saying. It's as simple as that. No mystery there. Karen Grigsby Bates, NPR News.
And Karen covers race and ethnicity for NPR's Code Switch. You can visit Walter Mosley's LA at npr.org. This is Morning Edition from NPR News. I'm Renee Montaigne.
And I'm David Greene.